The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the Athletic Women's Football Podcast. Coming up, Williamson's World Cup is over. The Gunners fire back and sweet Caroline. Hi, I'm Lindsay Hooper and with me today it's the Athletic's Charlotte Harper. Hello to you, Charlotte.
Hello, Lindsay.
Have you had a good week?
A really good week. A really good weekend. Chelsea Barca. What more could you want?
I know, we're in the middle of the semi-final ties. What a time to be alive when everything's still in jeopardy. No one's out, no one's in. I love it. We've also got Laia Cervello, who's speaking to us from Spain. Laia, so good to have you on. And we'll be talking all things Barcelona with you later. Have you had a good week?
Yeah, of course. Like in Spain, in Barcelona specifically, yesterday was like a festive day because it's Sant Jordi, a day where people just give books to other people and roses. And it was funny. And obviously with the winning of the Barça against Chelsea, it was better.
I got schooled about this yesterday by some Manchester City players. I think it was Casper Eye who was leaving the dressing room and had a rose. And then there was another rose right behind. I was like, what's with the roses? I didn't realise this, Laia, but I also have to reveal that yesterday, St. George's Day, was also my birthday. So I thought, oh, maybe I might get a rose. I didn't get a rose.
So congratulations, first of all, for your birthday. And it's like a legend here in Catalonia, where, I mean, it's like a story that... you told kids that there was like a princess like many centuries ago that was kidnapped by a dragon, and then a soldier went to the castle and killed the dragon, and then she took up the princess. They fell in love, like a Disney movie.
It is a Disney movie.
Something like this. And then from the blood of the dragon, they grew up like roses. So that's why people is just giving roses to other people.
Well, I'm going to be trying to get a rose next year from somebody in that case. I imagine as well for the two of you, Charlotte and Laia, I know you've met before, but you must have exchanged details ahead of the Barcelona second leg, haven't you?
We were. I was messaging Laia this morning. So we're going to meet up for coffee in Barcelona. Champions League plans. We'll have a chat this afternoon of how we're going to cover it, which will be really exciting. And yeah, a bit of cross-cultural Spain and English athletic combo.
Excellent. I'm glad I got you both on whilst you're still friends. That's great. this week, though, we do have to start back in England with Leah Williamson.
That's a worrying sign. Yeah, Leah Williamson down for Arsenal, and that does not look good. They cannot afford to lose another huge player. And you see the reaction there straight away from Leah Williamson. This does not look good for the England skipper.
Yeah, it's the news that none of us wanted. Leah Williamson doing her ACL, meaning she's out of the World Cup. So gutted for her. So gutted for the Lionesses, the fans, for Arsenal. And of course, it is the Lionesses losing their captain ahead of a World Cup. We are going to talk the science part about this later with a consultant knee surgeon, Andy Williams. He's operated on five of the Euro-winning Lionesses squad, including Chloe Kelly, who scored the winner in the Euros, but also Aoife Mannion as well at Manchester United. So from a footballing perspective first, Charlotte and Laia, I'm going to get your opinions. It is a huge blow. England have lost a household name, potentially the poster girl of the World Cup, I would even go as far as to say. There is an article as well, Charlotte, on the Athletic website for anyone who wants to get up to speed with what happened and how the injury came about. It's a huge blow, isn't it? What on earth do we do?
Crack on. That's all you can do, really. I know Chloe Morgan, my editor, and I were in the office, and when the news came, you just felt quite empty and deflated, really. Just because Leah Williamson is not only an instrumental player on the pitch and off the pitch, but she's extremely well liked among the squad and a great personality as well. And for all the credit that Serena Wiegmann and her coaching staff have received, you have to remember that Leah Williamson is the link between the players and the coaches. And for England to have had such success in the Euros, she played a huge part of that.
The two big questions that have come as a result are to do with the captaincy, who will captain England now, and also the centre-back issue. Who will be the centre-back partnership now? So, Charlotte, let's start with the captaincy issue, because we don't know whether Millie Bright is going to make it either. This actually knocks on with the centre-back issue too. So who do you see being England captain at the moment? Let's take it that Millie Bright isn't part of it, because she's not part of it at the moment.
Isn't? Wow.
Well, she isn't, is it? She isn't. She hasn't been playing. She's not available at the moment.
No, she hasn't. Okay. Without Millie Bright, you have Lucy Bronze as a potential contender. I'd say she would be my first choice. And then in the mix, someone like Mary Earps from the back. I would be surprised if that was the case.
Alex Greenwood?
Alex Greenwood, potentially. But for me, first choice absolutely would be Lucy Bronze if Millie Bright is out of the picture. But Emma Hayes gave us an update on Bright, saying that she would be out for weeks. Now, that's a very careful use of words, because somebody could be out for 12 weeks, which is 3 months. But I interpreted that as weeks, not months. And so given that Millie Bright is vice-captain, I'd expect her to step up to the plate as wearing the armband for England when fit.
We will keep everything crossed that that does happen. So if she is available, who's partnering her in defence? Is it going to be a case of moving Alex Greenwood into the central defence role, maybe putting Jess Carter in her place? We've seen that trialled already by Serena Wiegmann. Or is it a completely different option?
I think first choice centre-back pairing would be Bright and Greenwood, and somebody would have to fill in at left-back. My biggest concern, though, because we have depth at centre-back, it's not as if we're not short of central defenders, but my biggest concern is actually cover for that central defensive midfield role. So what happens if, and I'd hate this to happen, if Ciara Walsh wasn't available? The plan B was that Williamson would step up into midfield. So I think that's the biggest concern for Wiegmann, is that we're lacking depth in that number six central defensive midfield role.
Just when Rachel Daly thinks, I'm now a recognised striker, do you think she could be called back into a left-back role?
She could. It's an option. And that's why Daly is so attractive as a player, because she's versatile as a number nine or as a left back. But then you have to think, okay, well, you're going to shuffle the pack. Would Wiegmann go back on that? I then answer, well, if Daly is an option at left back, then do you recall someone like Bethany England?
Mm-hmm. I think, Charlotte, we've got to talk Steph Horton. I was at Manchester City against West Ham, and not only did she score on her birthday, which we share a birthday, she also has that leadership quality. She's been playing more regular football. She has never been completely ruled out by Serena Wiegmann, although the noises haven't been all that positive. But do we see that that could completely change now in light of this?
It's a really interesting case. I don't think Wiegmann will recall Horton. I think the fact that she didn't call her up when Greenwood and Bright were out is telling. She said in her press conference that she was happy with the quality in the squad at centre-back position. And Serena Wiegmann is not a sentimental person. She will be not looking at the name, not looking at what it means, not looking at Steph Horton's incredible England journey and all that she's had to endure to get back to where she was after her injury. Some are calling, saying that Horton has that experience. There is enough experience within the squad, but it will be really interesting, this narrative of how Serena Wiegmann manages that and whether even she considers it.
Could she be being stubborn in another way, though, in a way that goes against Steph? There's not having sentimentality, and then there's ignoring the obvious when it comes to experience, you know. For instance, I think from my point of view, if it was a choice between Lotta Wubben Mooy and Steph Horton, I know which one I would be going for. Obviously, in Serena, we trust. But what I'm trying to get at is there a bigger issue at play when it comes to voices in the dressing room? It could upset bringing a strong character back in who's obviously been so central to everything prior to the last major tournament. Is that playing a part? Is that why it's not happening? Because I don't think it's even to do with sentimentality anymore. I think that was lost a long time ago.
Steph Horton's been playing very well for City, and Serena Wiegmann has said that she will always kind of pick on performance. So she has to measure up whether Horton is as good as her other centre-backs available. Experience, you can't replicate that. It depends which way Wiegmann wants to go, whether it's a calm head and Horton has that international major tournament experience, she knows what it's like at a World Cup, or she sticks with her pack and doesn't give Steph Horton a look in.
Mm-hmm. Laia, you will know about ACL injuries because the best player in Spain, the best player in the world, Alexia Putellas, did her ACL. Has there been more research on that area in Spain as a result since? And is there anything you can tell us that might help?
Research is being done on this in Spain. In fact, last September, there was a congress in Barcelona about that. Now there are not that many players who give up football because of this injury, something that was very common years ago, I would say. Since women's football has become more professional in Spain, I think much more consideration is being given to the implications of, for example, menstruation in sport, something that affects in that kind of injuries. It might seem very logical, but a few years ago, when women's football was very neglected in Spain, nobody took it into account. And I think now it's starting to happen.
Well, let's dive into the medical side then of the injury that's caused Lea Williamson to be missing for this World Cup. Earlier on, I caught up with consultant knee surgeon Andy Williams from Fortis Clinic, and Andy has done the ACL surgeries for Chloe Kelly, Aoife Mannion, works with Chelsea and Manchester City as well. This is what he had to say. Andy, we really appreciate you giving us some of your time, especially considering the topic that is ACL injuries at the moment. I imagine that your phone has been going off the hook.
Well, it's no problem at all. It's a pleasure because it obviously is a very topical thing with this cluster of injuries of really high prominence, female players in particular. And it seems to be an incredible period of a few months where some really big name people have gone down with it. So I'm not surprised you asked to interview me.
There has been a lot of focus in this area, rightly so, because of the amount of ACLs that we've seen occurring in the women's game especially. Do you think there is a reason behind the amount that we're seeing in the women's game that can be explained not just physiologically? I mean, that's the area that you would be coming at it. But is there anything else that you see that's glaringly obvious that's different to when men do their ACLs?
I mean, I think there's a cluster of phenomena that are coming all together. But these women to have been so successful, they can't have knees that want to blow their ACLs. Amongst the children, unfortunately, there are a group who are just destined to rupture their ACL, and they never make it because if they blow their ACL in their early mid-teens, they miss too much football and never keep up with their peers. So most athletes who get to 21, at least, I would say, are put together right. So what is it? Women do have a significantly higher risk of ACL rupture than men. And so that's related to their sex, and that risk is probably seven times greater. So it's immense, really. There are lots of aspects that might explain that, such as the angle of the femur on the tibia. Women tend to be a little bit less bow-legged than most of the male players. And if you look at a male team, most of those players, when they're being photographed, have got bowed legs. With women, they tend to have straighter or occasionally not need alignment, and that's a risk factor. There's also some possibility that the within the middle of the knee joint at the end of the femur that has almost like a cavity, a notch in it, that notch might be smaller, and that's where the ACL lives. And if that notch is smaller, it means there's less room for excursion of the ligament, and therefore it's more likely to get chopped by the femur moving onto it. There are other aspects such as strength and sort of weight power ratio, etc. And there's even been a linkage to menstrual cycle, and that does seem to be an issue. Whether it's direct or whether it's indirect, it's very hard to know. But the other problem is that the level of play has gone up and up and up, which is obviously fantastic in terms of making women's football attractive to watch and hopefully attracting the TV money that one day will give parity to the women compared to the men, who seem to always have the best of the best. So firstly, the level of competition is going up, plus the intensity of play is going up and the amount of play. And so players often are fatigued because of that stress on them to get out and play. And the other aspect, I think, which is getting less of a problem, and I certainly used to notice it, is that the female players could often join professional football late based purely on their skill levels, and that what they weren't, some of them at least, they weren't well put together athletes, and just being skillful was good enough to get a contract. Whereas the way that men's football is run, the boys with talent are usually picked out by the time they're 10 years of age, and they've received the best training and they become very good athletes very early, and the athleticism protects them from injury. So there's a whole bunch of things I think that have come to the fore, really. The truth is you can just be unlucky and have a spree of injuries. I remember looking after Chelsea Football Club since 1999, at least at the men's team, and there were no ACL ruptures in the first team squad for 10 years, and then there were three in a season. And obviously there's a lot of investigation as to why, but it probably was just bad luck because there were no more over the next few years. So it's possible we're just seeing an unusual number of clustered together. But I think there are factors that are making it more likely. And as women's football starts to mimic the male game more and more, there's more stress on the knee and therefore there's more risk of rupture.
Is there anything in the healing process as well? I spoke about Aoife Mannion earlier, who you've dealt with, and she's done it more than once. We've got other players in WSL. I'm thinking of some at Spurs at the moment as well that are exactly the same, and they've repeatedly done that ACL injury. Is it something to do with the healing process that is different that makes that more common in women as well?
So I hasten to add, I didn't do Aoife's first one. I did the second one. Mm-hmm. There are some very practical things. The tissue we use for an ACL, we take a graft, so-called, and for professional football or elite football, my strong preference is to take it from the front of the knee, so-called patellar tendon graft. But women have smaller patellar tendons as a physical issue. Plus, I mentioned earlier on, they often join the athlete level later. And so when they were growing, they don't have the stresses that cause a reaction from the body to produce bigger, stronger tissue. So there is a practical issue in that everything is smaller. And because they have an increased risk of rupturing an ACL in the first place, they have an increased risk afterwards. And so over the years, people like myself have fine-tuned the technique by choosing the right graft, the patellar tendon, I believe, and by adding an operation on the outer side of the knee that also helps protect the ACL, so something called a tenodesis. It's actually an old-fashioned operation that was thought not to be necessary, but our data now is really strong. It's not just mine, but other surgeons around the world have shown by adding a tenodesis, it hugely reduces the risk of re-rupture. It's taken me down from about 7% to 2%. So there are things that can be done, but of course I do that for the men as well. So it's not female-specific, but female ACL reconstruction is at more risk of failure, and therefore surgeons need to be really wary that they address every single issue in the knee, such as meniscus tears, as well as the ACL.
If you were doing your own research right now into this, where would you focus it first?
With regard to women's or just overall football?
Let's go women's.
Well, the first thing to do is get data. And there's a lot of data on men's sport and there are various reasons for that. But women's data is really weak. And when I've done my research to follow up what happened to players after injury, it's all on the internet for the men. You can find what happened to a 16-year-old at a certain club, how long did they last, when did they get back, etc. But the women just vanish. And so first of all, I think a very simple thing is to really concentrate on getting good data. And I'm sure the FA have already started to address that. I've not seen that come through yet, but I'm sure records are improving. As the investment in women's football increases, people will be interested in data. So therefore, I think it will come naturally. But we need to get a move on, you know. No questions. So that's the first thing. Mm-hmm. I think there's been already a lot of study on the anatomy of the knee, and I'm not sure that we'll learn much more. I think we need to learn a lot more about strength and how neuromuscular control will protect the knee, and how the female athlete is somehow got a second best hand when it comes to neuromuscular control. So, for example, a risk of ACL rupture or re-rupture if they've had surgery in any athlete is bad mechanics when they land. So women will tend to drop their knees inwards and effectively describe a knock knee position. And that is certainly a risk factor in the men as well. But in women, it's much more common. So if we can work out how to counter that and train female athletes to deal with that as a second nature without thinking about it, may protect them. But one thing I've noticed with, you know, if you look at that European champions team, the women are real athletes. I mean, over a 10, 20 year period, they look different. And interestingly, in terms of their pelvic alignment, their lower limb alignment, I think they're looking more male. And maybe that's natural selection. And maybe the girls who have got a more male shape to the pelvis or lower limbs have an advantage over the girls they grew up with who don't. And the ones who don't have the more male look to their limbs, they get weeded out because, unfortunately, like natural selection, they do blow their ACLs and have other injuries, and they just never make it. But it did strike me that the shape of the partition of the hips, the way the players move now in the female game, is, I think, increasingly more male. And maybe there's an inherent favour towards that.
That's a really interesting observation. Let's finish off by just talking about the fact that we're waiting for research. It's something that's been mentioned with everyone that I've spoken to, is that, you know, more is needed. It's going to have to be done. And that means that it's going to have to take time. So in that interim period, Andy, what would you recommend to players, to clubs, to anyone at grassroots level to do to try and reduce the risk of getting an ACL?
I think the simple things are avoiding overload and fatigue. Now, if you play when your muscles fired up and ready to go, you're much less likely to get injured. And so there are a number of programs. FIFA, I have something called the 11 Plus. There's a program called the PEP, PEP program from the States. And a lot of that is about proper warm-up, getting the muscles engaged so that you're not caught cold and have a twisting injury you don't deal with. So that's on match day or training day to have a proper warm-up, but also to spend perhaps more time relatively in the gym, getting strong, doing drills that will really heighten a player's ability to play safely, shock absorb safely, and remain stable, rather than simply using football to become a good footballer. I know previously people didn't invest the time and effort because, you know, I'm sorry to say, but it often boils down to money, and the male players are often viewed as, you know, very major financial assets. And so guess what? They get protected, whereas the girls are often an oversight or just a second best, and it's really unfair. And arguably they need more of it than their male counterparts. So I think strength and conditioning and maintenance of those, of strength and conditioning plus proper warming up, is a very simple thing to start. And I think there's decent evidence that prevention programs do work.
Thank you so much for your time. It's been great to get that insight, and we'll be keeping an eye on all of the work that you're doing as well. Thank you very much.
Yeah, great pleasure. Thank you.
That was me speaking to Andy Williams from Fortis Clinic. There's lots of ACL coverage on the Athletic website as well. Now, though, we move on to the Champions League, where Arsenal also miss Williamson.
It's Marlon. With the Moy. That's a lovely pass for Palaver. Blackstenius waiting and will put it in. Some turnaround this from Arsenal.
Even without Williamson, Arsenal managed to fight back from two goals down to claim a 2-2 draw against Wolfsburg in the first leg of the Champions League semi-finals at the Volkswagen Arena. Michael Cox is joining us from a German airport because he was at this one. Did you see that coming, first of all? 2-0 down, I think many had written Arsenal off.
Yeah, I suppose I have mixed emotions in response to that question. One, at 2-0 down, I think Arsenal were, you know, in danger of kind of going out before the return leg. And I didn't really see that they were going to mount a comeback at that point. That said, I actually thought their tactical plan had worked quite well at 0-0. The first goal, I think, was a really well-worked move from Wolfsburg. The second one, obviously, a bit of a freak goal. But I didn't think Arsenal were playing disastrously overall. And I think, in a way, I mean, everything about Jonas Eidevall's plans were obviously dictated by the injury absences. But maybe the fact that he didn't really have anything else he could do actually helped Arsenal, because they just continued with plan A. And I think eventually they got a foothold in the game. The goal before halftime was crucial. And the second half, I think they actually played as if 2-1 wasn't going to be a bad result for them. I think if they'd left it at that, maybe they'd be confident at the Emirates. They would have won by a goal or two goals as they did in the previous game against Bayern. And so to win the second half 1-0, if you like, and make it all square, I think, you know, given the circumstances of injuries and going 2-0 down, is an absolutely brilliant result for Arsenal. I think Wolfsburg are a good side. I think they'll probably be better next week. I think they were probably surprised by Arsenal using a back five. And if that happens next time, I don't think, I think Wolfsburg will have planned for that.
You mentioned the back five. Was that how Jonas Eidevall plugged the Lea Williamson gap with this one?
In a way, I think he almost worked backwards. You know, he just chose 11 players who I think he trusts and have the experience to play at this level, and kind of worked out the best formation for them to play in. I'm not sure he would have played that way had Williamson or indeed Kim Little been fit. But yeah, it was needs must. I mean, you look at the bench, Arsenal didn't really have much experience at all, aside from in the goalkeeping department, and you're not going to call on them from the bench. So yeah, I don't think it was how he would have wanted to play, but I think they made it work. They made it work with, I think, a really good effort from Stinner Blackstenius, who obviously is the centre forward, but did a really good job dropping back into midfield and picking up Lena Oberdorf. That meant Arsenal weren't outnumbered in that zone. And they had a few shaky moments, I thought, with diagonal balls into the zone behind Maritz on the right, and Lotta Wobbenmoy, I thought, struggled a little bit with the aerial balls. But Jen Beattie was obviously the big beneficiary of it, and she was just fantastic at the back, really good aerially, and I think just provided a kind of physical quality as well. I mean, I watched this game back, this game from last year, it was the quarterfinal last year, and Arsenal lost 2-0 in Wolfsburg. And I thought Arsenal got physically bullied a little bit. You know, Wolfsburg, quite a wily, experienced side. But, you know, Beattie, I think, set the tone for just a real kind of commanding performance at the back. And I think all over the pitch, actually, Arsenal coped really, really well with, I think, quite a physical Wolfsburg side.
It's not been a good week for Wolfsburg with injuries either. I mean, if we think that they've been stacking up for Arsenal, Alexandra Popp out injured for Wolfsburg, missed the Euro final, of course, back in the summer, and a huge miss for them. The Champions League top scorer, Eva Pior, was at it again. What did she offer that's different to Popp? Because a lot of us that have watched Germany over the years will know exactly what Popp offers, but might not be as aware of what Pior offers.
Yeah, I guess a similar kind of player, really. I think a good all-round number nine, maybe a little bit old-fashioned in that, you know, very much a penalty box striker and took the first goal very well. But I mean, sadly, I mean, Pop's had so many injury problems over the years that I do think Wolfsburg are almost accustomed to playing without her. Obviously a big miss, but I don't think it changed too much about their tactical approach. Whereas I think for Arsenal, obviously, the not just Williamson's absence, but Kim Little as well, just means they don't have a third central midfielder, really. They just had to completely change the system. So, injury absences for both sides, but I do think Arsenal's were a little bit more demanding and difficult for them in a tactical sense.
You've already alluded to the fact that there's a plan A for Arsenal and there's plan A only, especially with the personnel they've got available. What would you do, though, tactically, Michael? Would you change things for this second leg? And I'm thinking from both teams, actually, you know, from a Wolfsburg perspective, what can they target now with Arsenal with this depleted squad?
Yeah, I can't see Arsenal doing too much different. Like you say, they just don't have too many options. I think the only one that Jonas Eidevall might consider is just bringing in Laura Wienreuther. I thought she did very well after she came on for the last 20 minutes. Wolfsburg, I think, actually had the right approach. Lots of diagonal balls in behind worked really well. Maybe we'll see more of that next week. But I do think the fact that Arsenal have kind of shown their hand gives Wolfsburg a slight advantage, just because I can't see Arsenal playing any different. And I think Wolfsburg we'll probably spend a week on the training ground just working, you know, how to play against a back three or a back five, whatever you want to call it, because I don't think they would have been expecting that.
Which way do you think it's going to go, Michael, at the Emirates?
That's a tough question. I'd say Arsenal narrowly favourites. I think home advantage is quite big at the moment, I think, because a lot of these sides still just aren't used to going away from home and playing in front of massive crowds. And the ticket sales at the Emirates sound really fantastic, and I think it's going to be quite difficult for Wolfsburg to go out there an attack. So I just about have Arsenal favourites. Of course, could go to extra time, home advantage there as well. So yeah, it's really tight. But I think Arsenal just about in the driving seat.
If they're just about in the driving seat, Chelsea are in the back seat, I think is how we describe it, going into their second leg. Let's move on to Chelsea. Well, who knew that the game between Chelsea and Barcelona would be settled in the fourth minute? It was, though, with a spectacular strike, a long-range effort from Barcelona's Caroline Graham-Hansen. Loved that finish from her. Chelsea able to see this one out, Michael, and just keeping it at 1-0. So they're certainly not out of it altogether. But of course, that was their home leg. That was at Stamford Bridge. They've now got to go away. Do you think that this is going to be too much for them to try and overcome?
Personally, I think it'd be really tough. I actually think Chelsea did quite well defensively. They, in a way, did what Arsenal did. They played a back five. I think they compensated for quality in certain positions with just numbers. I was quite worried, really, for Maren Mjelde and Magda Eriksson, who I don't think has been anywhere near her best this season. But I thought they coped quite well defensively. I think the frustration is being undone, obviously, by such a good individual goal, you know, a goal that was quite difficult to stop. And personally, I thought Barcelona just went into their shell 1-0 up. To me, they seemed entirely happy with 1-0, delighted to go back to the Camp Nou with the advantage, and they'll be very confident they won't be beaten in the second leg. But I must say, I think there's a big gulf between these sides, and I think if Barcelona had turned it on and played at their best, I think they could have won by a couple of goals, to be honest.
Is that how you saw it, Laia? Did you think that Barcelona would be happy with that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, last week we were talking about it and I was saying that Barcelona, since the last final of the Champions League, maybe here we are a bit pessimistic because of the many injuries that the team has had. I think people here didn't see like Barca winning the Champions League at the beginning of the season, something that I think it's beginning to change after the match against Chelsea. People was more aware that maybe Chelsea will be more efficient, like, in the defensive part than maybe other teams in Spain. So people here is very happy about it because they know that it's something hard to achieve in Stamford Bridge. And obviously because like the second leg is at Camp Nou, something that to me makes Barcelona the favourite.
Charlotte, you were there as well, weren't you? And I thought it probably was another case. You know, Michael talked about the back five that Arsenal played with, and Chelsea had a back five here. Did you always think they were going to do that and set up that way?
I didn't. And neither did Ciara Walsh. I spoke to her after the game, and she was surprised that they went 5-3-2. She said that she's played against them when she played for City and knew that they could do that. And Barcelona took a bit of adjusting, especially in that midfield area, to really adapt to Chelsea's unexpected tactical shift. But I think Chelsea really coped with that midfield area well, having two and then a three. So Kerr and Wrighton up front and then the three in midfield actually prevented Barcelona going down the middle and using Bonmatí and Walsh as effectively as they wanted to. It was Patry who was dictating the tempo for Barcelona. But Chelsea were very resolute, and a great performance from Maren Mjelde. Magdalena Eriksson really stepped up to the mark as well. But yeah, what a goal for Caroline Graham-Hansen. Surely we have to talk about that. Amy Rijkaard, reporter at Goal, pointed out she's never been on the long list for the Ballon d'Or, which is just nuts.
That is insane. It's really insane because she's been at the top of her game for a very long time. And we talk about world class and we always talk about consistency, and she's been up there. So it is incredible. Michael, did you feel that Barcelona were able to nullify Sam Kerr? I think you've got a lot of other passengers around you now. It's starting to swell, that airport, I can tell. Did you think they managed to cope with Sam Kerr, or was she just not fed and didn't get the service?
The service thing was a bit of an issue. Emma Hayes specifically said that when Chelsea tried to find her, she said they missed out one pass. It was almost like they just hoofed the ball towards her from defence rather than trying to, you know, feed through the midfield and play a little bit more of an intelligent pass. I think they actually did okay. I mean, Kerr and Reuten, haven't really seen Reuten play that much up front, but they had that offside goal. I think it was clearly offside, but that showed they had the right idea. They had another chance, I think, later in the first half. So yeah, it was a little bit timid from Chelsea. They weren't under the cosh for as long as I thought, but when they did have the ball, they weren't really putting Barca under sustained spells of pressure. And I mean, I'd be interested to know what Charlotte thought of this, because I was at the game, I wasn't working, I was just in the stands. And I was just surprised how kind of flat the occasion was. It didn't feel like a Champions League semi-final. And it didn't feel, to me, if I was a Barcelona player, I'm not sure it would have felt that intimidating. I mean, there were a decent number of people there. But to me, it doesn't feel like Stamford Bridge is as home to Chelsea women as maybe the Nou Camp is to Barcelona, or even the Emirates is to Arsenal. It still feels, I mean, to me, it felt like a bit of a neutral stadium, to be honest.
I think, yeah, Arsenal have really built their fan base and captured those new fans from the Euros euphoria, and Barcelona as well, with the history of their club. But yeah, 27,000 at the Bridge. Again, it was a good attendance, but we're expecting more considering how far women's football has come just even in the last year. And I'll bring in Laia. I don't really buy this, Barcelona saying that they struggle away from home. I mean, they're not losing drastically, but we're expecting them to put three or four past teams, and then 1-0 against Roma, 1-0 against Chelsea. And they say it's about mentality, concentration, and again, coming up against supporters who are not on their side. But it didn't feel like a hostile crowd. I understand that the Nou Camp is their fortress, and they have so much energy from their fans that it gives them a boost. But I wouldn't say going to the Bridge was a really tricky environment to play in front. It felt quite nice for them.
Yeah, I think it's not about being weaker away from home. It's about how they felt at home. So I think it's the main difference, because it's true, like I said last week, that maybe the weakness of Barcelona is their mentality, because they are used to winning in Spain. So when they are in troubles in a game, or they are struggling to win a game, last year they looked fragile, and you could see that in the final of the Champions League. And it's something I think they have started to change this season. They are working about getting better at this point, and you could see in a lot of games. But yeah, I think they feel so strong at home, and maybe people expects that to happen also away from home. But it's true that maybe in Stamford Bridge, at some point, I agree with Michael that if you hear like the sound of the stadium, it seemed like a neutral stadium, because like the Barca supporters were just singing so loud. And yeah, I don't think you can just say that they struggled because they were in a hostile stadium. So I think it just that Chelsea did well in a defensive way, and they are not used to that in Spain, and that's it. I mean, Chelsea, it's so good at the defense, and it's the only thing that happened also in Rome, I think.
And will Pateas play the second leg, do you think?
I think it depends. I mean, she has good feeling about his injury. I know that she wants to come back, because she's an obsessed of football, and she wants to play every game she can and be the best every time. But Jonathan Giraldez would be just cautious with it, because obviously has been 9 months since Putellas played for the last time. So I think if things go well and Barca managed to finish the game early, maybe Putellas could have some minutes at the end of the match. But only I think if Barcelona managed to have like some advantage in the game. But obviously, I mean, it's the perfect environment for Putellas comeback with all his supporters there, just to give her like a big ovation. So I think if it's possible, that would happen.
Charlotte, Michael, do either of you see Chelsea overcoming this 1-0 deficit and turning it around in Spain?
I think it's highly unlikely. Barcelona are favourites for me. The problem is that Barcelona are so good at keeping the ball. And the only way that you make them feel uncomfortable is really taking the game to them and applying pressure. And I wonder if Lauren James will start. Because if Barcelona go behind or feel slightly rattled in the first 15, 20 minutes, that's when you can get underneath their skin and it's out of their comfort zone. But then that exposes Chelsea. If you open the game up, the game plan has always been for Chelsea is to defend resolutely and hit them on the counter with long balls to kind of Sam Kerr as the target player. I'd be interested to see what Michael thinks about whether Hayes will change her tactics at all.
Yeah, I expect she will. I think Lauren James will probably come in to be a third attacker, if you like, regardless of what system it is. I think her reading and Kerr is pretty intimidating for any defence. I think it's a massively uphill task for Chelsea. I think they probably need some kind of freak event. I mean, if there's an early red card or something for Barcelona, you never know what can happen. But I just feel like Chelsea are going to be under such sustained pressure that it's going to be difficult for them. I think they probably needed to get their noses in front and go to Spain with something to protect. But winning away at the Nou Camp, I think, is probably beyond them.
This is the Athletic Women's Football Podcast.
Outside of the Champions League, we can't forget the WSL relegation and title race, both still up for grabs. Manchester United beat Arsenal 1-0 on Wednesday. That means they stay top. Down at the bottom, Brighton also beat Everton, meaning they moved off the bottom of the table. Leicester are now bottom with a game in hand on Reading, but it is against Chelsea, that game. Is anyone rethinking their predictions that we made given some of these results that are coming in? And it was impossible in the first place. I know for you, Laya, we haven't put you on the spot yet, but for Michael and Charlotte, I have done. But because it's so open, it's difficult at both ends to work out what's going to happen. I've always said that I thought Reading would be in trouble. Not necessarily that they would go down, but I did think that they'd be right in it till the final day. And then towards the top, I've never really seen past Chelsea. Has anyone got anything to add here?
Well, I am just thinking about my friendly bet with Chloe Morgan, who I said Chelsea. I'm still backing Chelsea. Two games in hand. The ball's in their court. But Manchester United, yeah, they're ones to watch. I didn't think they would be, but there's something about them. I suppose it's whether they can see it out. So I'm still backing Chelsea though.
Okay. Well, for the very first time, because I'm going to come to you, Michael, I heard goal difference mentioned at the weekend. Manchester City scored 6 past West Ham, and Gareth Taylor in his post-match interview said, yeah, we had got goal difference in mind. Do you think it could even be that tight? Have you wavered at all on your thoughts?
No, I still fancy Chelsea. I didn't expect Manchester United to be up there, to be honest. But looking at goal difference, Manchester United have got a really big advantage at the moment. So there has to be a couple of quite hefty wins for Chelsea maybe to overturn that. Yeah, I still fancy Chelsea with the two games in hand, I think is really important. And I don't think they'll have more than one more Champions League game to think about, although I could be wrong on that. So yeah, I always fancy Chelsea to just get the job done, even if they're not at their best, they usually get results.
If anyone is backing Manchester City to come from behind, the goal difference for them and United. So United have got 38 and Man City plus 23. So a significant difference still, but you never know. Villa, we've always thought that they would have a say in where the title goes. Well, next weekend, United travel to Aston Villa. That could be a key game. We'd love to know your thoughts. Which games are you keeping an eye on next weekend? Where do you think the title will go? And who do you think will be relegated? Use the hashtag AthleticWFP. Big congratulations to Bristol City, who have been promoted to WSL for next season. Soon it's going to be party time as well for Barcelona as well. They've won all their league games so far. They should win the league on Sunday, shouldn't they, Laya?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's... I think like the main difference between this Barca, maybe Barca from last season, is that they can win without the starting team. I mean, they have, I think, a really rich bank. So, yeah, I think it would be like a really good game to win the league.
Is there such thing as it being too easy? You know, when you look at a squad's development, often we think with Barcelona, the real test for them, they come in Champions League. And is there a disadvantage to not having that test domestically?
Yeah, it's something Alexia said after the final against Lyon last season, because having no competition in La Liga and having such a difference between the first, between the leader and the second one, it's a massive difference. So it's something that it's not going in advantage for Barcelona. And at some times it can be quite boring because Barcelona is just winning every game for five goals in advantage. So it's something that I think it's affecting the players, because the only league that they are taking in account or that they are feeling that they are competing is Champions.
For Michael, your name hasn't been called over the tannoy yet, which means your flight has not departed. But we are departing ourselves. Time is up for this week's Athletic Women's Football podcast. Thank you to Charlotte, Michael and Lia. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you,
Lindsay.
And as always, thank you to Sophie, our producer, for putting this together, and to you at home for listening. Do join the chat using the hashtag AthleticWFP, or you can go and use the handles at The Athletic FC and at Offside Rule Pod. Until next week, bye-bye.
The Athletic.